This has been a great morning. Did everybody hear me okay? Okay, very good. Just starting out, you know, coming into the center and seeing everybody set everything up. And then the people working in the kitchen and the people setting all of this up. And Ted working on the sound and the music and all the components that come together. It's amazing. I feel so honored to be able to just be here to speak after everyone has kind of set the table for me, you know? It's really amazing. And then what a wonderful introduction. Thank you very much, Michael. I appreciate that so much. Well, let me get myself organized here because we're going to do a lesson today. And what I mean by that, as opposed to what I usually do, I guess, I don't know. What I mean by that is that this the Centers for Spiritual Living, the first 4 weeks of the year, traditionally study the first four chapters of The Science of Mind. Now, some people may say, oh gosh, we got to go through that again? How many years have I been here, you know? We go back to the basics. Okay, I got it. I know already. I got it down. But the fundamentals are really important. And so I want to share with you a story about fundamentals. In 1961, and I know a lot of you weren't around at that time, there was a team called the Green Bay Packers, okay? And they were coached by the famous Vince Lombardi. And Vince Lombardi was like, you know, he's considered one of the greatest coaches that ever lived, right? And so in 1961, in July, that team, they were ready to begin their season training. Because the year before, they had lost in the finals, in the last seconds of the finals, to the Philadelphia Eagles by just a few points. And so they were ready to build on what they already knew. And they were gung-ho. But you know what? Vince Lombardi had a different thought about that, a different idea. Vince Lombardi wanted to take them back to the fundamentals. And when I say take them back to the fundamentals, he started their training with, this is a football. And then he began, and he started teaching them, reteaching them, some of the best players in the world, how to tackle, how to properly block, about proper balance and weight shift, all the very basic fundamentals. And what you'll find is the most successful coaches in history have had this focus and detail on fundamentals. John Wooden, great basketball coach, and I think still the winningest coach ever, he would start each year teaching his team how to put on their shoes, how to properly put their socks on, how to put their shoes on, and he would teach them one play. And a lot of times they would start their preseason with just one play until they perfected it. However, it's not just football and basketball where this strategy is useful. Throughout our lives, a focus on fundamentals is what determines our results. It is easy to overestimate the importance of one critical event or one big break while simultaneously forgetting about the hidden power that small choices, daily habits, and repeated actions can have on our lives. Without the fundamentals, the details are useless. With the fundamentals, tiny gains can add up to something very significant. Simple ideas deeply understood. Nearly every area of life can be boiled down to some core task, some essential component that must be mastered if you truly want to be good at it. Mastery in nearly any endeavor is the result of deeply understanding simple ideas. For most of us, the answer to becoming better leaders, better parents, better lovers, better friends, and better people is consistently practicing the fundamentals, not brilliantly understanding the details. So I thought this was pretty applicable to what we're doing for this next 4 weeks, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to shift to my more intense glasses. Hope you don't mind. Okay, these are my Sally Raphael glasses here. Okay. And that comes from When Pride Still Mattered, A Life of Vince Lombardi, written by David Moranis. So, this is a Science of Mind textbook. Okay. Some people were listening. Okay, good. And this textbook was written by Ernest Holmes. And so I want to share a little bit about Ernest. He was born in January 21st. And so I figured it out. So the people that are doing the third chapter, that's going to be on his birthday, I believe, or really close to it, real close to it. On the 21st of 1887, and he made his transition April 7th of 1960. He was heavily influenced by Waldo Emerson. And some of the things that he embodied from Emerson were these things. We are our own spiritual authority. Think about that. We are our own spiritual authority. We are individuals. We have an individual relationship with God. It is unlike any other relationship. So my relationship with God isn't the same as Reverend Michael's or Reverend Kathy's or Andy's or whoever. My relationship, each one of us have an individual relationship and perception of who and what God is. There is a God-like essence in everyone. A God essence in everyone. That is that perfection that resides within each one of us. And that perfection, it cannot be harmed, damaged, it cannot be in any way violated. It is always there, it is always perfect, it is always whole, complete, it is always available to us as we turn to it. And thirdly, there is some kind of connection between our thoughts and what happens to us. Well, I think we're all pretty familiar with that, right? We're going to get into that a little bit more. So later on, he was also influenced by the writings of Thomas Troward or Troward, depending upon what side of the pond you're on, I guess. Plotinus, Quimby, Mary Baker Eddy, Emma Curtis Hopkins, Walt Whitman, Meister Eckhart, St. Augustine, St. Teresa, Kipling, Wordsworth, Robert Browning, and as many of the transcendentalists, and then also many of the Eastern teachings and philosophies. I'm not going to get into too much because I could do the whole lesson on Ernest Holmes, but I will tell you that he believed in what he referred to as a golden thread. Does anybody know what a golden thread is? What that means? What's that?
Common idea.
Yes, exactly. It was the idea that different teachings and different religions and different expressions, that there was a common thread between those things. And so he seeked to identify some of those common threads. And why wouldn't there be, right? I mean, there's just one. We know that there's just one spirit, one mind. And it's expressing itself all the time. So, of course, there would be commonalities in different teachings. So I want to share with you a little bit from this other book I have. If I can find it. There it is. Living the Science of Mind. That was nice. Okay. And so here are just, and I'm going to just take little snippets, okay? Here are some just common ideas from different teachings. So in the Bible, I am the Lord. I change not. One God and Father of all, who is above all, and through all, and in you all. I am Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the ending. From the text of Taoism, the Tao, considered as unchanging, has no name. There is no end or beginning to the Tao. The great Tao has no name, but it affects the growth and maintenance of all things. From the harmonic teaching, defines God as power that naught can e'er surpass, the power with which no one can make comparisons of any human thing at all. This teaching defines God as oneness, which is the source and root of all and is in all things. From the sacred books of the East, there is but one Brahma, which is truth's self. It is from our ignorance of that one that Godheads have been conceived to be diverse. The one God who is concealed in all things, in all beings, who pervades all, who is the inner soul of all beings, the ruler of all actions, who dwells in all beings. The Buddhism. In Buddhism, we find these thoughts. The supreme being, the unsurpassed, the perceiver of all things, the controller, the lord of all, the maker, the fashioner, the father of all beings. The golden thread, the commonality. And so it is with that in mind that Ernest Holmes wrote The Science of Mind. And so what did he do? He started the first chapter, and what's the title of the first chapter? The Thing Itself. The Thing Itself? What does that mean? The Thing Itself? Sounds almost blasphemous. I think I need some water. When I was, I want to tell you a little bit about my father. My father was a brilliant man. One of the most intelligent people I've ever met. He consumed literature and books like you wouldn't believe. He was an editor and he was a writer. And he would read four or five books over the weekend and a couple during the week. And he had a huge library. And he just loved knowledge and loved reading. And he learned and studied many of the different teachings as well. He spoke multiple languages, 3 to 4 languages at one time. Not at one time, but, you know. I mean, he knew them at one point in his life. One of which was Latin, of course, because in his day, that was a language they really wanted to make sure everybody knew. But in all of his brilliance, he was horrible as a handyman. He couldn't fix a thing, okay? And so as a kid, he would always get, he'd get under the sink or he'd get behind the dishwasher or the washing machine. He'd try to fix something, right? And his frustration would grow, and you could kind of hear his frustration grow. And it was always about that time that he'd call for me to help him, to be his assistant, right? And so in his frustration, I became the person that would hand him tools, okay? So in his frustration, he would forget the name of the tool. You know, the thingamajig, the whatsamacallit. So I wanted to make sure I was grabbing the right tool out of the box because I didn't want to get him to get more frustrated about it, right? But it was frustrating for me. Why? Because the thingamajig or the whatchamacallit or that thing with the blue hand or whatever, that thing, it could be anything. Brilliant, yes? Brilliant. The thing itself, the thing, it can be anything. What if he had said, what if he called it God itself? He is writing this book to describe a teaching that is open to all teachings. God is kind of more of a Christian sort of a thought, and so those kind of concepts and ideas would come along with that. He didn't want to do that. He didn't want to influence his description of God by labeling it in that way. It's the thing, you know, the thing itself. That's what it is. Okay. To suppose that the creative intelligence of the universe would create man in bondage and leave him bound would be to dishonor the creative power which we call God. To suppose that God could make man as an individual without leaving him to discover himself would be to suppose an impossibility. Individuality must be spontaneous. It can never be automatic. The seed of freedom must be planted in the innermost being of man, but like the prodigal son, man must make the great discovery for himself. Okay, so that's a huge piece. So we're going to break that down a little bit, okay? So, to suppose that the creative intelligence, capitalized creative intelligence, another name for the thing itself. You see, he pulled a different tool out, didn't he? He called it creative intelligence. To suppose that the creative intelligence, so this thing itself doesn't just create willy-nilly, it's creative intelligent. It is creative intelligently with purpose. Of the universe, to suppose that the creative intelligence of the universe would create man in bondage and leave him bound would be to dishonor the creative power, another term, meaning the thing itself, which we call God. Why would it be dishonoring? Why would that be dishonoring? Yes, exactly. We are a reflection of God. To say that we are in bondage, it doesn't even make sense. We are of God. We are endowed with God. We are all of us, all of it. We are all of God. Now, they're all of us together or just a part of God still, but we're all, each one of us, God, made of God. And so it wouldn't even make any sense that we would be put into bondage. To suppose that God could make man as an individual without leaving him to discover himself would be to suppose an impossibility. Okay, and that includes women too, by the way, not just man. Remember when this was written. Well, this makes my teenage daughters very happy. Right? Because to suppose that God would make man as an individual without leaving him, her, to discover himself would be to suppose an impossibility. Why? Why? Why would that be impossible? We cannot be anything else. In truth, we are each one an individual creation. Each one of us. We can only, and as an individual creation, we can only discover God for ourselves and to know God as in a way that we know God as an individual.
We're also not automatons.
Yes, that was the next one. Yeah, no, that's okay. That's all right. No problem. Individuality must be spontaneous. It can never be automatic. And Carolyn shared that with us. That's good. The seed of freedom must be planted in the innermost being of man. But like the prodigal son, and that's a huge but, okay? That's a massive but. But like the prodigal son, man must make the great discovery for himself. You have to discover God for yourself. I cannot discover God for Connie or for Kat or for whoever. I can't do that. And neither can any of the other teachings, by the way. You must discover God for yourself. You see, it's why I came to this teaching. Because it didn't feel right for me to be told how I had to believe and how I had to know God, and that anything other than that was wrong. It didn't feel right. So this teaching for me is perfect. Okay. In this chapter, Ernest not only describes what God is, but why it's important that we know and understand God. And this particular piece, my first class that I took with Reverend Christine, and I think she's here, there she is. I remember reading this. It's on the first page of the first chapter. The divine plan is one of freedom. Bondage is not God ordained. Freedom is the birthright of every living soul. All instinctively feel this. The truth points to freedom. Why does the truth point to freedom? What does that mean? That is all there is. Infinite possibilities. Choice and option. And so as we are connected to the truth, okay, and that's the key, our connection, and when we are willing to release this mental thing here that we have that tries to reason and everything, and we go into that inner voice, and we're willing to allow that greater to be known to us, as we move into that, that truth points to freedom. We do well to listen to this inner voice, for it tells us of a life wonderful in its scope, of a love beyond our fondest dreams, of a freedom which the soul craves. Who doesn't want that? Right? Sign me up. And I did. I did. You see, it's not freedom from. He's not talking about freedom from fear, freedom from poverty, freedom from whatever, okay? He's talking about freedom to. Freedom to do. Freedom to be. Freedom to create. There's a little subtle difference to me in that. I'm not being saved. I'm simply expressing the truth that I am. And that truth is freedom. And from that place of freedom, I have all the power, unlimited. I'm able to create from that place. Okay. Whatever the nature of any principle may be, insofar as it is understood by anyone, it may be understood by all who take the time to investigate. This does not require an unusual degree of intelligence, thank goodness, but rather a practical application of what we now know in order that we may increase our knowledge. I like that too. This is a teaching that you got to go out and do it. This isn't about just talking about it. This isn't just intellectualizing about it. We're talking about applying the things that we learn. Application. So where in the center can we get application? Pardon? Classes, yes. In service, yes. Who said that? Yes. What else? Application. Because without the application, yeah. Daily practice, meditation. Surrounded by the same people in a group. Yes, it's so nice. Yes. For me, the thing that moved me probably along the most and the best were the classes, you know. Because what happened was, not only did I learn about the different concepts and ideas, but in those classes, you're given homework, okay? But it's homework that improves your life. It's not just like, you know, doing math problems. It's homework that improves your life and who you are and how you see the world. It's homework that teaches you how to discover different ideas and thoughts that you may have that maybe need a little work and need to be changed. Not only that, you make these amazing relationships with people I still am in contact with from when I very first started. And also, you know, that creative intelligence, there's a reason that you're there with that group. I've come to that belief as well. Because most likely, there are people there that are also teaching you, as well as the instructor, as well as the readings, but each individual contributes. And so it is a really wonderful, wonderful way to go. Okay, and it gets you way past just the lesson of the week, which I have only a few more minutes. No. You know, when I first took the class, I thought I knew much more than what I really did, you know. They started talking about love and law. And having been previously divorced, I figured I knew all about that. But that wasn't it at all. You see, the universe never plays favorites. What does that mean? God always says yes. Very good. Very good. Beautiful. Yes. Very nice. It's all God. You're responsible for everything in your experience. Good. So God is not arbitrary, okay? We don't believe in that. What's that? It's a principle. Yes. So for an example, God isn't sitting up there and saying, Reverend Kathy, you have amazing hair. I think I'm going to make sure she has a great day today because I love her hair. I just love her hair. And Reverend Michael, he makes everybody's hair look beautiful. I'm going to make sure he has a great day. But that John Boyle guy goes to Supercuts. As Dr. Carolyn pointed out, this universe is set up and based on principles and laws. So what are laws and principles? So first, before I go into spiritual laws and principles, give me some physical laws and principles. What are some? The law of gravity, yes. The law of electricity. Cause and effect. Viscosity of water. Right? And so what does it mean? What does that mean that it's a law, it's a principle? What does that mean? It's consistent, yes. Measurable, yes. Provable. And one of the biggest laws that you may have missed is Boyle's Law. It's related to gas pressure, so we're not going to go there. Okay. So we got the idea there, okay? So spiritual laws. And so what Dr. Holmes is saying is that the physical laws that we can see that appear to us, that there's a reflection of that in spirit, and that there are spiritual laws that maybe we can't see, but that exist, and that the universe operates according to these principles and laws, okay? And so some of those laws might be the law of attraction, law of giving and receiving, law of circulation, law of harmony, of grace, law of freedom, law of manifestation, law of gratitude. Am I running that late? I am, aren't I? Oh my gosh, I got to page one. Okay, here we go. So, so we have these the idea that this basically everything operates and runs according to laws and principles. And so, what is it when we go to pray? First of all, what is prayer? What is prayer? Attention. Very good. Yes? Thoughts? Movement of thought. Why do we pray? To realign. Thank you. Yes. Is it to let God know, hey, you know what? I'm a little short on my rent today, and I could really use a solid here. Could you give me some, you know, a couple $100 and everything's good? No. We already have at our disposal unlimited power, abundance, all of it. Prayer is used to realign our thoughts, to get in alignment with the thing itself. It's not to let God know what's going on, because God is all-knowing. So it doesn't, there's nothing there. It's for ourselves. We are creative beings. As creative beings, what does that mean? It means that our thoughts create our situations, right? And so as creative beings, how often do you have a thought? Did anybody have a thought today? Like a bazillion, right? So constantly, our thinking is constantly creating our experience. So if there's something in your experience that you're not really thrilled about, what's the logical thing to do? What's that?
A new thought.
Change that thought. Now, has anybody ever felt frustrated or felt levels of fear or anything like that in your life? Raise your hand if you've ever felt that. Ever at any point? Oh, I'm so glad. I love that. That is wonderful news. It is great news. Do you know why that's such great news? First of all, you're being honest, okay? Second of all, it tells you that there's something you get to work on. I love that stuff coming up. I don't like it, maybe not right at the moment. But after I have a little space, give it some space, I go, wow, that's so cool that I now realize that this is something that I get to transform into love, that I get to change, that I get to identify. And if I struggle with it, I can go to a practitioner and I can get work that way. I can make changes. It's nothing to be upset about. I mean, I'll tell you what, I get out of alignment all the time. I do. I got out of alignment this morning when I was taking a shower. Somebody had taken the shampoo out and took it and put it over, you know, on the sink and stuff. So I had to get out of the shower to go get the shampoo. Silly. Silly. That was for you.
Your daughter helped you?
Always she does, always, yes. But it's always about coming back into alignment. That is where our power is. And since I'm short on time, I'm not going to keep you much longer, but I will just tell you this, that I appreciate your understanding here. I hope you got a lot out of the lesson. And the good news is the other three chapters cover a lot of the first chapter, too, so you're good to go. Namaste.